Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Juno Diaz, whose latest book is a collection of short stories, This Is How You Lose Her. Juno Diaz is author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, and also another collection of short stories, Drown. Fiction editor at Boston Review and professor of writing at MIT. I want to start by asking a little bit about your character, Junior, because he appears in virtually every story. He appears in the novel, and he has your history, sort of, but he isn't you, I would hope, right?
No, he's not.
How many stories had you written before Junior came along, or was he from the start?
I had an idea for Junior at the beginning. Listen, my entire project had certain preoccupations, and I kept looking for a character. I kept looking for a protagonist that would allow me to address some of these preoccupations. I kind of wanted to talk about gender. I wanted to talk about masculinity. I wanted to talk about race. I needed a character who was fantastically honest, fantastically observant. But the problem was that I also knew if I was going to make him these things, I needed him to be remarkably flawed and self-deceiving. And I think I wrote at least for a few years before I stumbled on the perfect combination that would cohere around this character called Junior. But yeah, I think it was 3 or 4 years where I was dreaming of him, but didn't get him right. It wasn't about the 1994 that I wrote my first story with him.
And was the voice then fully formed?
No. I mean, again, the Junior's voice has been a work in progress. This is what happens when, you know, you're writing over a long period of time. Few of us are perfect and capture things right at the beginning. I think that Junior finally hit his stride in The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, but he wasn't half bad even in my first book, Drown.
And he's got a very distinctive voice, and it's a voice that is very informed by your own reading, particularly science fiction and fantasy, which means you go back in reading that stuff. We were talking before we went on the air. You lost count of the number of times you read Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, that's probably the most honest estimation. I've certainly lost count. I mean, without question, I've read it once a year since I was 9. So there's that, plus throw in a few more dozen here and there. Whenever I feel real depressed, you go back to books that gave you great comfort and great information. And that's the case. And, I grew up at a time where a lot of the libraries still had the golden age of science fiction on their shelves. So I grew up with ABC. I grew up with Asimov. I grew up with Bradbury / Bova. I grew up with Clark. And of course, go over to H and Z. We've got Heinlein and Zelazny. And then, of course, there's the final D, which is Delaney. I grew up surrounded by that stuff.
There aren't that many people of Hispanic origin writing science fiction, though.
No. This is an area that's growing the hell up. You see a lot more new writers of color, a lot of writers of U.S. Latino descent. But, you know, as a kid, science fiction made perfect sense to someone like me who had lived such extreme reality. I had gone from a 1970s third world. We're not talking about a 2012 third world. A 1970s third world, and then suddenly moved to New Jersey. It was as if you had gone in a time machine. It was extraordinary. The U.S. to a kid like me felt like science fiction. And so when I was reading science fiction stories, you know, for a kid like me who grew up in the shadow of dictatorship, American realistic fiction or realistic stories or sitcoms had any traces of the world that I had left behind. But in science fiction and fantasies, I saw a lot of myself reflected.
You say in Oscar Wao, and you've actually said in an interview, that Trujillo was kind of like Morgoth from Lord of the Rings.
Sure.
He's
our Dark Lord. Our Dark Lord, a shadow that, you know, extends through time and that haunts the very people he afflicted.
And Balinger, then, I don't know if I got the pronunciation, is kind of Sauron.
Yeah, or a minor sort of demon. I mean, I always call him the election thief, but these two characters, man, the Dominican Republic certainly could have done worse, but not by much.
There's one story in This Is How You Lose Her, Juno Diaz, which is about Junior and his brother and family first coming to New Jersey and dealing with snow. Is that pretty much autobiographical?
I think the physical elements of it are. I think my experience was very, very different. We weren't like locked in. We weren't on house arrest that way. I also had two sisters, and their sort of experience really added to ours. The memory of the cold and the memory of the neighborhood I drew upon. But these particulars of Junior's experience with his crazy father and with being locked into the house are invented.
The brother Rafa, he's still alive now?
Well, yes. I mean, I have a brother who's completely different from this brother. I mean, the brother in this book, of course, is sort of a satanic extremity of my brother. He's completely, completely different. I mean, when I was arranging and creating Rafa, I always kept saying, if Junior's New Testament, Rafa is Old Testament. Rafa's the guy who comes to your house and takes your eye out because you tried to punch him in the face, where I don't think Junior sort of lives in that reality.
And they're both very much into bodybuilding, particularly Junior after Rafa dies. Were you into bodybuilding too?
I lifted weights for a very, very long time. You know, Junior is the kind of guy, again, I abstract some of my experience and put it onto Junior. I enjoy the thought of how much Junior attempts to hide his vulnerabilities, encasing it behind all this flesh. Where you see the brother doesn't seem to be particularly aware of vulnerability. The brother throws himself on the point of a knife any chance he gets, but Junior lives most of the time terrified.
In all of these stories, did you ever work out any timeline about their lives?
Or
did you just go from?
Of course. Well, yeah. And you always have to leave room for the fact that there's always more than you can ever recount. You know, any recollection of your life is by its nature incomplete. And so I kind of leave room for it to breathe. I leave holes. But certainly, no, I filled a whole darn notebook sort of sketching out which way this family was going and which way Junior was going till about his 40th birthday.
So in the last story in the book, Cheater's Guide to Love, is that Lola from Oscar Wilde?
In the last story of the book, it is implied that it has something to do with Lola. But I'll tell you what, there's a story, Miss Laura, in the book, where the girlfriend that he meets at Rutgers, who has his head shaved, the mujerón, that is Lola.
Juno Diaz, let's go back a little bit. You grew up in this environment, and you read a lot. Were you always thinking about being a writer?
No. I always wanted to read. I always thought I was going to be a historian. I would go to school and study history, and then end up in law school. Once, you know, I ran out of loot trying to be a history high school teacher. But my dream was always to place myself in a situation where I was always surrounded by books.
Junior goes to college late. I mean, he starts when he's in his 20s. Did you start immediately after high school, or did you wait as well?
No, I started immediately after high school. I was in one of these situations where my mom was like, either you're taking college classes, even though you're working full-time, or you can live on the street. And it was a smart thing for her to do, because if I hadn't been kept busy, I would have definitely just lost my way. I was one of those kids who, I got to tell you, man, I was not the smartest kid growing up, but who is?
But you went off to college, and were you writing in college then?
Well, my first year I went to one of these kind of small state schools, a commuter's college. I wasn't writing then. I was just working, hustling classes, delivering pool tables, chasing girls the way we did at that age. And then it was only when I went to Rutgers and I began to really discover a totally different world of literature with the power to transform lives, literature with the problem to intervene in larger questions of the society. And I'd never really kind of, I have to say, I'd never really appreciated how profoundly powerful literature could be. And it wasn't until that experience at Rutgers University, at Rutgers College, that I began to take seriously my love of books, my love of storytelling, my love of narrative, and think, hey, this might be something that I could do.
Well, at around that time, I know that when I was in college, I was probably read the same books you did. Then after that, I kind of moved away from science fiction and fantasy and expanded outward and sort of stopped looking back. But you kept reading it, too.
No question. Listen, I always put Toni Morrison, Sandra Cisneros, Leslie Marmon Silko, Maxine Hahn Kingston, my most important university authors, with William Gibson. William Gibson struck me at the same damn time. New Romancer had basically come out a few years before I went to college. When I went to college, it was all the rave among the hip little nerd kids. And Gibson, not only as a sort of social critic, not only as a stylist, not only as a superb artist, was really, really important to me. I mean, he was just such a great, smart, progressive. And he lived in this world. Most people don't naturally put a Toni Morrison next to a William Gibson, but I could never have become a writer if these two books hadn't been next to me on my shelves.
What prompted you to write then, quote, realistic fiction rather than go directly into science fiction, particularly since people like Octavia Butler were using science fiction and Chip Delaney were using science fiction in a social context?
Sure.
And Le Guin as well.
But I mean, I can't speak for any of those three, but they seem to all come out of traditions where there had been an enormous body of work about the reality that they come out of. Even Samuel R. Delaney, Butler, Ursula Le Guin, we already have dozens of books about the African-American experience, about the African-American experience at Harlem, about the woman's sort of feminist intellectual experience. And so I think that in some ways there was a certain amount of freedom. Now I'm just thinking aloud.
Sure.
Where I come at a time where the Dominican Republic and the Dominican American experience and the Dominican diasporic experience was completely not present. It had been almost barely narrativized. And I felt like my Middle Earth, the world that I was going to sort of retrieve, the world that I was going to create, was this world no one had ever encountered, that no one had ever voyaged to. All the skills that I learned in science fiction and fantasy for world building, I brought to bear in building the world of Junior de la Casa's family, building the world of the Dominican Republic in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000. And in many ways, I feel that no more is Dahlgren a constructed world than The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde.
In reading Oscar Wilde, Juno Diaz, I noticed that the footnotes take Trujillo and the Dominican Republic and put it into this science fiction construct so that, in a sense, you know, we are walking into an alien world.
I no question. And we are making a world that, for some Dominicans, they think they know. We're making it alien. We're estranging them from it. Plenty of Dominicans who read this book are not used to thinking of Trujillo as a Sauron. It sort of destabilizes our definitions. And many people who, you know, are familiar with Sauron are not used to Sauron being linked to a, you know, 20th century Caribbean dictator. And I think that it's a helpful conversation. It's a helpful cross-pollinization.
The historical material in those footnotes, those are all real? That's all researched?
Oh, I would be very cautious. I mean, I would be very, very cautious of heeding those footnotes. They're not historical dissertations. We must remember in the book, Junior keeps flagging his unreliability, and Junior also keeps flagging that he's lying and making stuff up. He's like, oh, remember that last footnote? Yeah, it didn't happen at that time. I just did it because I liked it. As soon as you meet someone who's that cavalier with information, I would exhort you to be cautious.
Is Junior as unreliable, you think, in This Is How I Lose Her as in Oscar Wilde?
I think that Junior's difficulty with revealing who he really is not just a matter of his character world. It's also a matter of his relationship with anyone reading him. Because in all three books, Junior is the persona that is writing the books. And the actual reader is encountering Junior's persona even as they're reading. And Junior is asking them to play games, to believe him or not to believe him. And I think in the game of This Is How You Lose Her, the question of, is Junior reliable? Has Junior changed? Is a fundamental question for a reader.
Well, I want to go into a little bit some of the other issues that you were talking about, the political and gender issues. But I noticed in Oscar Wilde that it took a while for me, not having read Drown, to understand that Junior was writing the whole book. I knew it was someone.
Yeah, he's a deceptive cat that way. He's a deceptive cat. Listen, Junior's ability to mask his hand has been an important part of my project. Most people read This Is How You Lose Her and don't make immediately the connection of the one story that feels like it's not about Junior. Don't make the direct connection that this is Junior writing about the other woman, because Ramon is his father. The woman writing in Santo Domingo, her name is Virta. That's Junior's mother.
Ah.
Junior in Drown mentions that his mother lost children before he and his brother were born. And again, you would have to be a super, super nerd and have to have Drowned coming out of your ears to make those connections. But this is the way Junior likes to play. And I've always enjoyed that about him. I mean, I think of him, his writerliness as much a character as the character we meet on the page.
When you're writing Junior's perspective, when you're writing his perspective, how conscious is the manipulation, or is it mostly just unconscious?
No, it's very, very unconscious, very conscious. I always ask myself when I'm writing a book, what is the trick, especially since Drowned, what is the trick Junior wants to play on the reader?
Really?
Of course. Because Junior, that's Junior's gift, is his ability to sort of lure readers into a labyrinth, lure them into a house of mirrors. And with Oscar Wilde, I knew what the trick was, is that Junior reveals himself late to be the narrator, but also that Junior is hiding what a dictator he is in this book. Second of all, what is the trick that Junior plays in This Is How You Lose Her, is that Junior, in many ways, the book we're reading is not directly from me. It's Junior de la Casa's book. He, at the end of the book, is seen writing the book that now we realize that we've been reading. And the question is how much of this book is Junior trying to convince us of something, and do we believe what he's attempting to convince us of? And again, for most people, they don't care. But for sort of big-time nerdy grad students, this stuff is embedded in there so that they can sort of pick over it.
It also means that when he's talking about what a bastard he is, the question is, does he really think he's a bastard, or is he lying to us?
No, I think he thinks it. I think it would be this book would be a hard book to read and not feel palpably his regret, not feel palpably his recognition of what he's done wrong. We could say anything we want about this character, but unlike most of us who do bad stuff and then don't want to look back over our shoulder, Junior hovers over his crimes. And he's a very different character for that.
In bringing in the Dominican experience, the Dominican-American experience as an immigrant and as a Hispanic in the United States, how conscious are you of bringing in political ideas?
I think no more than, say, a John Updike or a Jonathan Lethem or a Rick Moody, no more than any of them. I think that most of us are aware that as writers, we're seeking absences, we're seeking silences, we're seeking spaces where people haven't entered. No writer is saying, hey, I want to go to this really well-trod territory and say exactly what someone else has done. Right. I think the nature of a writer, because we are attempting to bring to light areas that people haven't seen before, tends to in some ways be progressive, at least in that light. I don't think my book is any more political or any less political than, say, a mainstream novel. It's just that our politics are recognized in different ways. If you're a status quo writer, you're considered to not be political, but that's as political if you're a progressive writer. Some politics are asked to show their passports and others aren't. So in this country, if you're slightly progressive, people have a lot of suspicions that you're up to some sort of conspiracy, that this is some sort of plot. On the other hand, if you're sort of conservative and mainstream, people tend to take that as a given and don't notice the politics. So I guess I'm no more and no less aware than the average writer, I assume.
From what I've known of mystery writers, they're hyper aware.
Mystery writers are among the coolest of the cool because they can get away with doing wild stuff that very few mainstream writers can do.
In using the voice of Junior, you're creating a kind of kaleidoscope of his relationships with women. Now, we assume, reading the book, that he's being honest and these women exist. They may not even exist then.
Well, I don't think we want to go to the "it was all a dream" Dallas thing.
No,
I'm
just thinking it was all made up by Junior to illustrate a point.
I highly doubt that. I mean, the one thing about Junior, again, I'm talking for my character here, and I just take it for granted. But I don't think Junior's problem is that he's a dishonest chronicler of reality. I think Junior is incredibly honest about how he sees reality. Part of what makes a reader, if they read this book, squirm is how he will describe things as if he is an alien, as if he doesn't know that this is embarrassing, as he doesn't know that this is going to be shameful. He says a lot of things that on the surface, one would have to say it couldn't be anything but the truth.
Well, I walk away from it going, now again, I don't know if this is all men or just Dominican men are bastards and the women are right to leave them.
Well, I would say that as goes one group of men, goes all men. Rare is the culture that is immune to any of the stuff that's happening to these characters. And I think that part of the only reason I have readers The only I feel like one of the only reasons I have readers is because women from all sorts of cultures and all sorts of background read these characters, and not all women. I mean, again, I don't have all these kind of readers,
right.
But the readers I do have, they see themselves, they see their men, they see their women in these characters from this tiny little island in this tiny little state called New Jersey. They see them reflected in these people.
You use the N-word a lot. Why?
Well, because it's a normal part of Junior's life, and it also speaks to who Junior is. Everybody knows Carol. Well, not everybody, but if you grew up the way I did, there were always kids who went to college and got out of college and came from backgrounds where everybody used the N-word and college wasn't going to stop them from using it. And I think it says a lot about the kind of person Junior is that this is a word that, you know, he feels comfortable with, that he grew up with. Now, representing that doesn't mean that I approve of it.
It's there as part of his dialogue in a way that we've rarely seen.
Well, you don't see it as much, but it's certainly very present in the world I grew up with.
Juno Diaz, when it came time to start Oscar Wow, first of all, I noticed in Oscar Wow, maybe I missed it, we know all of Oscar's life, but we never learn about his father.
Well, no, it's intentional. Oscar doesn't need a father with someone like Trujillo. I mean, I thought the joke always was, the gag was, that in some ways we don't know about Junior's father either in this book, and yet both of them are the children, the sons and daughters of Trujillo. And I kind of realized that this was such a masculine culture that the patriarchal, the sort of patrilineal flow from Trujillo to Oscar is pretty explicit without even going through the vector of an actual father.
His last name, Wow, what kind of name is that?
Well, it's just a joke. I mean, his last name is De Leon, his real last name. It's just a joke. It's just a pun and a misunderstanding, a misnomer. When Junior says one day on Halloween at Rutgers, when Junior and Oscar are roommates and Oscar is dressed up as Doctor Who, and Junior says, "My God, you look like that quote-unquote homo Oscar Wow." And, of course, the Dominican kids all mishear this. Oscar Wilde, they're like, oh, it's Oscar Wow. And so he gets stuck with that nickname.
You said in an interview that Oscar was the composite of all the nerds that I grew up with. I would have been Oscar if not for my father or my brother or my inability to fit in any category.
I still feel that holds true. I mean, I was permitted to be nerdy in ways few kids were because I had a brother who could drop almost anybody. My brother could punch almost anybody the hell out.
So basically, if anybody tried to bully you, your brother would just...
Yeah, he would be second. My older sister, who ended up having a lot of trouble with a lot of what we call trouble with a capital T, everybody from the neighborhood knows what I mean, she would be the first person you'd have to deal with. And my sister would, in many ways, stab you sooner than smile at you. And so by the time they got to my brother, you'd have to have been a killer.
And you were never fat like poor Oscar.
No, I was a thin little scrapper. I was terrified of fighting, and yet I fought so much because you had to fight. Despite having two tough siblings, you still had to fight.
And you'd sneak off to the library and read, too.
Every chance I got.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I had the reverse. I had a ridiculously embarrassing patriarchal life where we boxed every Sunday and we went to the rifle range every Saturday. I had a military father and a military family. What was my dream? What was my escape? That I went to be a nerd. Most people grow up nerds and they dream of being Batman. I was the opposite. I was living with Batman and I just wanted to read books.
The story of Oscar Wow, was there anything, any person you based it on, or did that just take off?
No, it just took off. I have to say, it just, the idea in a hyper-masculine culture like America and like the Dominican Republic to make your hero a nerdy Odysseus felt so perfect that I knew I had to do it. It also came from, I'll never forget, I was on a panel with writers of color, males of color. And in this panel, all of the writers I knew were super serious nerds, and none of them mentioned their nerdiness. They were all kind of doing their postures of masculinity and their postures of coolness. But I thought, between all these guys, there's enough nerd to power MIT. And I realized that there was a silence around men of color and nerdiness that I also wanted to enter, and so that also inspired.
Well, it's sort of easier to enter the world of nerdiness if you know anything about science fiction fans, because they were, I don't know if they are now since it's moved on to, you know, video and TV and away from books, But you go to a science fiction convention in the 70s and 80s, and all there were Oscar wows.
Sure, but we're all white. One of the things that's really hard is that nerdiness is it's considered so racialized. Nerdiness is considered so white. And let me tell you, it is hard for, let's take comic book nerds. Comic book nerds have a lot of problems of understanding that there are also Latino, Black, Asian nerds. And it kind of, in some ways, it's been something the community's been wrestling with, is how to deal with diversity. And I think what was a shocker wasn't just a shocker for Latinos and people of African descent to see an Oscar wow, a super nerd. It was also a shocker for the nerd community to have to deal with somebody as awesomely nerdy as Oscar was. I mean, Oscar puts 99% of nerds to shame.
Well, not really, but okay.
You come from a far larger context. But
where
I grew up, in the worlds, the colleges I went to, if I lined up 10 of the white nerds from Rutgers, Oscar would have killed them as far as his nerdiness. He would have won the Olympics.
It's also true that if you get past Chip Delaney and, you know, Octavia Butler, back then there were, I don't even think, you know, any other African-American writers.
Well, not at all.
No.
It was a very, very white universe. I mean, it's still predominantly white, but it's changing and rapidly.
It's expanding in the same way that all of America's growing multiculturally.
Yeah. The slowest, though. I think comics and sort of the genres are the least representative forms. If you go to mainstream fiction is so much more diverse than, say, comics.
What about gender? I don't recall seeing any gay people, or did I miss something in either of those books? In either Oscar Wow or This Is How I Lose Her?
No, that's a good question. I don't think it's central to the concerns of Junior, and it's certainly an absence which I need to get on the ball with.
Did you see much gay life, or was it completely undercover so that you wouldn't have seen it growing up?
No, I mean, I think one sees it, and what ends up happening always, and this is sort of what makes it difficult, is that you can never get it right. You never capture the full diversity of the community in which you live in. And someone always ends up paying, and usually the wrong person. In this way, I mean, I think all my sort of queer and gay friends, you know, who would feel like, wow, where's our lives? You know, you realize that as one writer, you can never capture your world. And each book is an attempt to get closer and closer to that reality.
Well, it seems like This Is How I Lose Her would be getting closer to the lives of Latinas, of women in particular.
There's that, and that moment. Getting, I always think that this is the book which is where Oscar Wilde was about these larger sort of national, these larger profound ancestral questions. This is a book that really, really focuses, it drills down on the daily quotidian demands of intimacy. I mean, every time Junior gets close to being vulnerable, Junior does something to destroy it.
What was the purpose of putting a couple of the stories in second person?
Second person is just a way to get some distance. It's a really interesting form because it allows for a certain cooling down. I mean, again, not everybody likes it, but for me, the only way these stories worked, and again, I tried these stories for years and years, and the only way they came together was when I finally created a certain kind of cool, sort of collected space between the reader and the work.
Juno Diaz, I understand you're working on this giant epic called Monstro. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't know if it's giant or I don't know if it's an epic, but I'm certainly working on a sort of alien invasion virus, giant monsters eat Haiti and Dominican Republic novel. I don't know if I'll ever finish it.
Do you plan to continue writing about Junior then?
No, this book is a bit of science fiction, science horror, to see where it takes me.
Well, how do you feel about moving into genre? How do you think it's going to be accepted, or don't you care?
I mean, what do I know? There's stuff that you can control. And for me, the only thing I can control is whether I can write this book. And even that, I don't think you have a great amount of control, because sometimes books die on the vine.
How far into it are you?
Not far enough.
I read somewhere that the protagonist is a 14-year-old girl.
Yes, she is. The protagonist is a 14-year-old girl with at the moment obsessed with a Spanish mace, a weapon in the Weapon Museum of the Dominican Republic, which she will use to bash monsters' heads in.
What do you think of movies like Avatar?
I mean, what can one say? It's like the the greatest money-making Pocahontas story ever told. I mean, you know, technically it's wah, blah, 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 wonderful, but at the level of narrative, it's kind of like ABC, and yet people dug it. So what can I say? I mean, I'm not here to bash anyone's people, what they're vulnerable to. People are vulnerable to that old story of white man comes to a new world, falls in love with an alien princess, saves planet, yay.
And the film versions of Lord of the Rings.
I enjoyed them. I don't think they were very accurate, and I don't mean accurate just from the point of view of events. They were inaccurate to the sort of core of the characters, because in the movie Lord of the Rings, Gandalf gets played like Santa Claus. In the books of Lord of the Rings, Gandalf is a sharp, tetchy, bristly, proud old man who isn't there to give anybody a space hug. And I prefer him, and I prefer the Aragorn of the books, where Aragorn is a battered veteran in ways that even Viggo Mortensen, who I adore and I think did a wonderful job, I don't think he was given the role that he should have been given. I think had he been allowed to play the Aragorn of Lord of the Rings, he would have knocked it out the park in the actual books.
Do you still read new science fiction?
Of course, of course, of course. I love Nalo Hopkinson. She's absolutely wonderful. I adore her.
Jamaican woman writing science fiction.
I know, see? Yeah. I love Tobias Bucknell. He's new. He's great. He's got a couple of books out. Really, really smarty pants. You know, and then, of course, people who are kind of the colossuses, like Vernon Vinge, I'm still reading. Of course I'm reading.
Vinge, by the way.
Oh, is that how you say it?
Vinge, yeah.
Oh, that helps.
Did you ever read Joan Vinge?
Of course. Yeah. My God.
I used to do my show with a science fiction writer named Richard A. Lupoff. Does that name ring a bell?
I don't know why. Who is that?
Well, he wrote a book called All in Color for a Dime, which was a history of comic books, but he also wrote a lot of Space War Blues, Sword of the Demon.
Did he write a book on Edgar Rice Burroughs?
That was his first book. That was his...
Got him. Of course, yeah. I know him.
Oh, okay, cool.
So you can't mess with me, bro. You give me a cigarette of worth of time, and I'll figure it out. Yeah, man.
Juno Diaz, you worked on a movie called Washington Heights, is that correct?
Yeah. I did a lot of the rewriting for it. It was a vehicle for my cousin, the actor Manny Perez. It's kind of weird because I rewrote it and they didn't take the majority of my rewrites, but what can you do?
What happened when you found out you'd won the Pulitzer?
What do you always do when you find out that you win something and you're not, your mind can't grasp that your life is about to change? I know what I did. I sat down and just spent about 20 minutes in shock, and then the phone calls came in, and the next day I got up and got to work.
Did you feel any pressure for this book?
No. I mean, listen, I always say this, but it's true. I feel so much pressure, irregardless of what the outer world is bringing. I carry around on me, on my back, kind of on my art, a Himalaya. So who cares if you decide to add a pound of sugar on top of that? I can't feel it. You could put a Pulitzer on a Himalaya, and I wouldn't notice the difference.
Well, you've also got a bad back, so that...
Yeah. But still, the metaphor holds, sir. The metaphor holds.
And what are you working on now in addition to the epic?
Nothing.
Or whatever it is. Nothing.
Nothing. My little girl. I've got to get her. I got to get her up and killing 80-foot giants.
Has there been any interest from Hollywood on... Oscar Wilde?
There was. Scott Rudin, the great producer, bought the book. But, you know, nobody's in a rush to make a movie about Dominican nerds. There's no great bottom line on this. You know, you keep your fingers crossed.
One final question. What do you think attracts Dominicans to New Jersey?
What attracts immigrants everywhere to a place? It's always the jobs and the people who came before. My family immigrated to New Jersey right during the whole collapse of the manufacturing industries in New York. They were just bottoming out. And there were plenty of companies up and running in New Jersey, and people moved to those jobs.
As with you and your family, did you move around a lot?
No, I never moved around. I moved around once. I lived in the same two houses for the first 24 years of my life.
And you lived in Boston, and there's a story that takes place in Boston with Junior as a professor with a bad back.
Yep. And with a real paranoid sort of sense of victimization. He's kind of nuts in that story.
Now that you've completed this, do you think about writing stories from different perspectives now that Junior is kind of...
So I'm going to write a story about a 12-year-old girl killing skyscraper-sized monsters, so I'm hoping that's a different perspective.
You've been listening to an interview with Juno Diaz, whose latest collection is titled This Is How You Lose Her. I'm Richard Walensky. on Bookwaves.